Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Thursday, January 26th. And today we're going to catch up with our good friend, Barry Jacobson. We're going to continue our series about World War II. We're going to be looking at a few battles. We're in 1942 right now in our series, and we're going to be looking at the Doolittle Raid, the Battle of the Java Sea, as well as the Battle of the Coral Sea. So we've got some focus tonight on what we would describe as, I guess, military actions out in the open sea. And we will be doing that as we continue our series with Barry Jacobson. A couple of interesting birthdays today that might be. One is Bob Uecker, who, of course, is one of the funniest human beings ever born. Bob was a Major League Baseball player. Then he became the announcer, the radio announcer for the Milwaukee Brewers. But I think most of you probably know him when he was doing the radio broadcast on that hilarious movie, Major League. So I think that's probably where most of you know him. The other great man who was born on this day, of course, Douglas MacArthur. And he's got something to do with World War II, wouldn't you agree? I think Douglas MacArthur has something to do with World War II. And he was born on this day, and I don't have the exact date of when he was born, but of course it was the 19th century. Douglas MacArthur. Let me say hello to my good friend, Barry Jacobson. How are you, Barry?
I am well, Silvio. Glad to be here.
Well, I was just saying that this is Douglas MacArthur's birthday. And I don't have the exact date of when he was born. I think he died in 64, I believe. But he was born in the late 19th century. I'm sure that at some point in our series of, of shows about World War II, we'll be talking about him, maybe even tonight, Barry.
Well, if you remember, we did discuss him as the leader in the Philippines and the defense of Bataan. And I think we left
right.
him being evacuated and saying, I shall return. He was born on 26 January 1880, and he died in on 5th of April 1964.
Right. That's what I was thinking. 64 stuck in my mind, but 1880, I also said that Bob Uecker was born today, but he's got no relevance to our show other than he's one of the funniest men ever born.
And there's plenty to say for that.
That's right. So we'll kind of pass on him a little bit. But Bob Uecker is hilarious. I don't know what else to say. Well, we pick up our story, as you were saying the last time, we pick up our story sort of in the Philippines. And then we also mentioned last week that we're going to be talking about the Doolittle Raid, which was the first big adventure, military adventure by the United States. But we're also going to touch on a couple of other topics tonight. So why don't you give us a preview, Barry?
Well, we're going to talk about World War II, of course. And this is during probably the darkest days, just after Pearl Harbor, when both the Nazis in Europe and the Japanese in the Pacific were having pretty much their own way everywhere. We'll talk about the invasions of the South Pacific by the Japanese, the overrunning of the Philippines and other places. But the main thing we're going to talk about today is the famous Doolittle Raid, which was America's first attack on the mainland of Japan. It was our way of saying to the Japanese, wait just 1 minute, buddy. This ain't over yet. And you're not safe even in your own backyard, which the Japanese, of course, thought they were. So that's basically the topic of the day.
Good. Now, just for my information, I made me a note about this. I wanted to ask you about the Doolittle Raid. How well represented do you think the Doolittle Raid was on that movie Pearl Harbor that came out, I think it was 2001 or 2000, the movie about, you know, the little romance between you know, those two guys and the one girl in the middle. How well represented was the Doolittle Raid in that movie? Do you remember?
I do. And in fact, it's funny you should say that because for many military historians, that was the best part of the movie. The whole Pearl Harbor attack sequence was good enough. It was actually better done, I thought, in the movie film called Tora, Tora, Tora. Which is just about the raid without all the, you know, the romantic stuff they threw in the movie Pearl Harbor. But the movie had some, you know, some inaccuracies, and it was you know, was had lots of flaws as a movie, shall we say. But the Doolittle Raid section with Alec Baldwin playing Jimmy Doolittle was pretty much excellent. Very well done.
Yeah, I thought so, but I wanted to ask you about it because, you know, you would have a better analysis than me. Well, why don't we begin with Doolittle. I guess Mr. Doolittle puts this group together, and why don't we start there?
Well, as I said earlier, this is the darkest days of the United States. December, from the fall of the bombing at Pearl Harbor, all the way through April of 1942, was just one unmitigated disaster after another. The Japanese had attacked us 12 hours after they attacked Pearl Harbor. They'd attacked the Philippines and really inexplicably caught the American Air Force on the ground, unprepared, and knocked the Air Force out on the ground so that they had complete air dominance over the Philippines. And they overran the Philippines with the exception of the Bataan Peninsula, which, as we talked about last week, was defended by General MacArthur. But Bataan eventually fell, as did other places. The Japanese invaded Borneo. They defeated a combined British, American, and Dutch fleet at the Battle of the Java Sea and sunk, you know, several ships on 27th of February. Battle began 27th of February, ended on March 1st, our first great naval defeat in the Pacific. And they went on to occupy much of Indonesia. They also took over New Guinea, or large parts of New Guinea. They began the invasion of Burma. They even invaded the Andaman Islands off the coast of India. So it was looking very bleak. Singapore was besieged, the British fortress of the Pacific. Singapore was besieged and would eventually fall. Nothing was going right. So that leads us up to the Doolittle Raid. In January, early January, the president was asking if there was anything we could do to at least for the public's sake, give the appearance of something, you know, good to talk about. If there was anything we could do that would, you know, be a bright spot, if you will, in an otherwise pretty bleak landscape. And the problem was that Japan was too far away from any of our land bases. There was no way land-based aircraft could attack the Japanese islands. The closest island was Wake Island, and that, which we talked about last time we were together, was taken by the Japanese shortly after Pearl Harbor, after a heroic defense by the Marines. But that was gone, so we had nowhere to base long-range bombers out of. The other option, of course, is aircraft carriers. But in the Pacific, after the shellacking we took at Pearl Harbor, the only thing we had between us and Hawaii was a handful of aircraft carriers, three to be exact. And one of those would be badly damaged in the Battle of the Coral Sea. And in fact, another carrier, the fourth one, the Lexington, would be scuttled after the Battle of the Coral Sea. So we didn't want to risk sending our carriers close enough to launch carrier-based aircraft because we were so badly outnumbered by the Japanese at sea, and we could face the combined Japanese home defense fleet, the same fleet, in fact, that had just attacked Pearl Harbor. And lose those carriers as well. So that was out of the question. So during this period, a submariner captain came up with an idea, which was then forwarded to the chairmen of the Joint Chiefs for a novel way of launching a raid. And this raid would be not by carrier-based aircraft, which by their nature have short ranges, but instead by medium-range bombers that were small enough to fit on an aircraft carrier's deck, and yet had the range to reach Japan from far enough out where the Japanese wouldn't expect it, you know, beyond what we call the picket range, which is where they put their scout ships, hundreds of miles from the Japanese mainland, watching for incoming ships, and then radio back their position. So it had to be able to launch from beyond their picket range, and that meant many hundreds of miles. So this idea led to the Doolittle Raid, and the guy who was put in charge was a man named Jimmy Doolittle. Now, Doolittle was a colonel in the Air Force. The Air Force had just come into being. It had been the Army Air Corps before the war, and then shortly after the war started, it was retitled the Air Force. And Doolittle had been one of these pioneering flight guys from the 1920s. In fact, he was the man who pioneered, engineered instrument flying, where you fly by your instruments rather than by line of sight. If you think about it, there is no capability to fly in fog or cloud cover or bad weather of any kind unless you use instruments. And before Doolittle, that was not done. It was, you flew by basically the pilot would just look out his cockpit, and using landmarks below to sight by or a compass and map, he would fly. But that was very risky, especially if he flew into a cloud bank. So Doolittle was a pioneer of flight, eminently capable of leading this mission. So Doolittle was put in charge of this mission, and they trained in Florida for the most part, in North Carolina as well, and a little bit in Minneapolis. And they came up with a bunch of different options. Eventually landed on the idea of using B-25 Mitchell bombers. It's a twin-engine bomber, medium-range, medium bomber. Stripped down just to the bare essentials. Get rid of everything that might weigh them down. As I said in the movie, these are fat boys. We got to make them skinny ladies. And they threw off everything, including most of the armament. Interesting enough, one thing that took off the plane, isn't it? And one thing that took off the planes was their bomb sites, the Norden bomb sites, because those bomb sites were top secret. And we were pretty sure after they landed these things ultimately in China, which was the plan, I'll get to the plan in just a minute, that these planes would eventually be recovered by the Japanese. We didn't want the Japanese to get our bomb sites. So they had to rig up a special kind of bomb site for this mission, which meant they had to fly fairly low and use line of sight bombing, but that wouldn't much matter, as we'll talk about in just a minute. So that was the idea of the mission, to basically bomb Japan from long range from aircraft carriers.
Let me ask you a couple of very quick questions. A couple of things you said, and I made me a couple of notes here. The B-25 was the best bomber we had at that time because the B-29 came later. So the B-25 was really the best we had at the time, right?
No, actually, the B-17 would probably be called, or the B-26. Either one of those would have been a better bomber for most things.
Oh, B-26. Okay, I remember the B-26 from...
That's the Liberator. And then the B-17 is, of course, the Flying Fortress. That's the one that we use mostly in, most of our bombing missions with the B, particularly in Europe, was the B-17.
Okay.
Later replaced by the Super Fortress, which is the B-29.
The B-29 that was the one, of course, that dropped the atomic bomb, or both of them. Now, so that's one question. The other question is, you were talking about these Japanese ships that were scouting out in the ocean, and you mentioned they communicated back by radio to the headquarters to spot American ships, or any ship, I suppose, that they were looking for. Given how big were these ships? I mean, were they just like out there, and how far would they be able to see another ship? And I mean, it would be very difficult for these ships to not to be sunk by let's say in this case American submarines, right?
Yeah, actually there were no American submarines involved in the operation, but there was a flotilla that accompanied the two carriers. There were two carriers tasked for this mission. The Hornet, which would be where the Doolittle Raiders are based off of, and they flew off of that ship. But because its fighters had to be stored below deck and couldn't provide defense for the carrier if it was attacked by the Japanese, the Enterprise under Admiral Halsey, Bull Halsey, accompanied and escorted the Raiders. They also had some destroyers and a couple of light cruisers. But no submarines. Now, that said, to answer your question, these kind of boats the Japanese would use would be patrol boats, submarines, light destroyers, what we might call a frigate, spread out over hundreds of miles, lots of room between each ship. They'd have what they call patrol zones. They'd also use airplanes based off the Japanese islands, which would fly out and scatter around at closer ranges. But in fact, the patrol boat that spotted the Doolittle Raid, we'll talk about that in just a second, what actually went wrong, was sunk immediately thereafter by one of our cruisers after it spotted the carriers coming in, and did get sunk. But that said, it had time to radio in the position of the Americans and blow the whistle, so to speak.
Right. Now, and this, of course, this Admiral Halsey, somewhat related to Uncle Albert, right? Weren't they, I think, on the same song?
That's right.
Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey. That's right.
Couldn't get it by
hands across the water. Yeah,
that's
hands
right.
across the
yeah,
water.
Was,
yes.
Halsey was called the Fighting Admiral. He was played by James Cagney in the various World War II movies, in fact. By the way, there was another Doolittle Raid movie made in the 1940s, in 1944, called 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. And that was only about the raid. It was made, you know, a couple years later while the war was still going on. And as well as wonderful World War II propaganda movies, you know, where you just feel like going out and waving the flag after you watch it. And Spencer Tracy played Jimmy Doolittle in that particular film.
Right. But I think to go back to the point you made earlier, these movies, well, not the movies, but I mean the actual raid, the Doolittle raid, it was very psychological. I mean, the country needed a victory or needed something to show the world that we weren't just going to sit back and get hit like that. And I think that it's important to make these movies. I mean, a movie in 1944 was still during the war. So, you know, it was as much a, and I say propaganda, but, you know, some propaganda is actually good, particularly when you're trying to, you know, lift up the morale of the country. Other propaganda, of course, is different. But in this case, I wouldn't say so much propaganda. I would just say PR, you know, PR for the military effort, Barry.
Well, if you remember, we talked about this also last time we were together. The filmmaker Frank Capra made a series of films that's kind of off the topic of the Doolittle Raid, which we'll get back to in after the break, I guess. But, you know, it was these were called Why We Fight. And these films, which were showed as sort of shorts, we call them a short film today, were in a documentary film style. And they laid out in a very succinct, understandable fashion to the American public why we were fighting this war against the fascist. And really, really helped to mobilize American public support for a war that otherwise, particularly in Europe, wasn't going to be very popular because we didn't want to fight a war in Europe before you know, Pearl Harbor. So Capper had to show the American public, and he was happy to help the American government do this as part of his patriotic duty, to make these films showing that it was important to defeat Hitler, the Hitler and Mussolini. They weren't just Europe's problem. They were the world's problem. And
exactly.
The war was lost in Europe, but eventually come to the United States and come over here.
That's right. And I think it's also important to note, we'll take a break and then we'll come back and do a long segment on the follow-up to Doolittle. But I think it's also important to note, Barry, that at that time, you know, when you think of how the public could have been reached, you had radio, of course, and you had the movies, you know, and those were really the two. Of course, you also had print media. Most people would read a newspaper. But I think that the impact of these little, what they call film shorts, right, at the movies, you know, between the big movies, they would show something like this. I think the impact of that had to be tremendous on a public that was probably very worried about the war. I mean, you know, it's hard to imagine what it must have felt like at that time in 1942. The only thing I can equate it to, Barry, would be how we felt, let's say, for months after 9/11, Barry.
Yeah, I mean, with this exception, unlike 9/11, where we were angry and we had questions about whether we could defeat this enemy sooner or later, there was never a time where we thought the United States was in danger of being invaded or in danger of, you know, losing a war and becoming a conquered country. But that fear was very real, especially in 1942, where the Axis were everywhere victorious. At the time the Doolittle Raid was conceived and executed, we're going to talk about the execution in just a minute, but by the time it was conceived and executed, we had had no victories. We'd had nothing but a string of losses, just one
right
after another, you know, body blows to the American public morale.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a welcome relief. As I said, a bright spot in otherwise pretty bleak landscape.
That's right. That's right. Well, we're going to take a little break, Barry, and when we come back, we'll continue a look at the Doolittle Raid, and we're going to look at a couple of other things as well. We'll be right back. Well, this is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and we're looking at World War II again with our friend Barry Jacobson. We're about to hear about the Doolittle Raid or the execution. Take it away, Barry.
So the Doolittle Raiders steamed out of San Francisco on April Fool's Day, 1942, and at sea met up with the they were on course on the aircraft carrier Hornet. And they, again, they used B-25s because the B-25 had a short wing span and a short takeoff. It didn't take much to get it in the air. And once they lightened it, you know, by stripping it bare, it was able to get off the deck of an aircraft carrier. B-26s were ruled out because they had too broad a wingspan. You couldn't get near as many planes on board. The original plan was for 20 such bombers, but after some mechanical failures and accidents during training, they ended up with 16 flight crews. Each one had five men on the flight crew. Each bomber was loaded with five bombs, and these were 500-pound bombs, specially rigged up for this mission. So they didn't have a real large payload because this is really a symbolic raid. Just like they didn't have the Norden bomb sites, they didn't really need them. Accuracy wasn't the point, and maximum damage wasn't the point. The point was to strike a blow. Might only be one blow. Might even be, not even be a particularly significant blow, but this is all about morale. So 500-pound bombs, four of those on each plane. And interesting enough, five of those bombs had attached to them specially minted friendship medals the Japanese had given to the United States during peace negotiations before Pearl Harbor. You know, leading up to Pearl Harbor, the Japanese were trying to snow us. They're trying to fool us into thinking they had, you know, no violent intentions, no warlike intentions. So the Japanese gave the United States delegation during the peace talks these friendship medals. And so we returned them to Japan by attaching them to these bombs that we're going to drop on their cities.
Pretty
which
original.
Is appropriate.
Yeah. I like
so,
that.
So the flotilla steamed towards Japan. And on 18th of April, 7:30 in the morning, they're still about 650 miles off their launch point from Japan. It wasn't time to launch yet, but they got spotted by a Japanese picket boat, a small patrol craft, which then radioed to Japan, warning there were American ships coming that direction. The boat, of course, that I just mentioned earlier, was sunk immediately by gunfire from a U.S. cruiser, but the damage was done. And so Doolittle had to make the decision, do I carry out the mission or do we do abort? Now, the problem was they were not close enough yet to attack Japan and then continue on as the mission called for and land in China. Landing fields had been prepared in China by the Chinese resistance to the Japanese that were friendly to the United States, fighting for Chiang Kai-shek. And aircraft were supposed to land there, and then pilots would then be recovered, and then they'd fly on to Burma from there, or from Burma to India. However, this threw a wrench in the gears. Now they had to make a decision. If we attack Japan from here, we're too far out to get all the way to China. We'll run out of fuel. So now it takes on the character of being a suicide mission. Despite that, Doolittle and the captain of the Hornet made the decision to go ahead and launch the planes. And so at 7:50 in the morning, they launched. They basically took it. There was a 10-hour flight. They arrived three-hour flight. They arrived in Tokyo around noon. And not just Tokyo. There was two planes bombed Yokohama, one bombed Yusuka, one Nagoya, Kobe, and Osaka. They were all bombed. But the main attack was on Tokyo. And they attacked the industrial heart of the city, dropping bombs in Japanese factories. Two of the bombs in each payload were incendiary, creating firestorms. Or fire damage. And then they flew on towards China. None of the planes were shot down. Only one of the planes was even hit by anti-aircraft fire. Japanese were completely taken by surprise, which was astonishing considering that they had already spotted the American flotilla. But I guess the Japanese had no idea that the Americans could launch bombers from an aircraft carrier. And they knew the aircraft carrier planes had a much shorter range. So the Japanese were completely in the dark about how we went ahead and bombed them. They assumed incorrectly that we'd used some kind of long-range bombers at a Midway Island. And it was this mistaken perception, that would eventually, a few months later, lead to the Japanese decision to attack Midway Island and lead to the Battle of Midway, which we'll talk about next session. So the little raid went off like clockwork, with one exception. Now they had nowhere to land. They did not have enough fuel to get to China. That said, they flew on towards China, expecting to have to ditch in the ocean, and then a miracle occurred. A tailwind came out of nowhere, a very strong tailwind, and gave them just enough lift to get them over China, over the coast of China. And then shortly thereafter, they had to bail out as their planes ran out of fuel, and the planes crashed while the pilots parachuted to the ground. Jimmy Doolittle, interesting enough, landed in a rice paddy on a huge pile of dung. He literally landed in the shit. and that leads to a really interesting story. First of all, because he had lost all of his planes, Doolittle thought that when he got back, he'd be court-martialed. And in fact, he got the Medal of Honor instead. But he assumed after he lost all those planes that his career was over. Far from it. Doolittle would later go on to lead the 8th Air Force against Germany in the massive bombing campaign that eventually brought Hitler to his knees. But that said, at that point, he was literally and figuratively in the shit as far as he was concerned.
One quick question about landing in China as they did. The Chinese, from the movie, I remember that there were Chinese troops, of course, who greeted them. But the Chinese were not unfriendly to these Americans because there was no reason to be at the time, I guess.
Yeah, well, in fact, there was two parts of China. There was Japanese-occupied China, which is where they landed. That was basically the whole eastern part of China. And then the western part of China was fighting against the Japanese under both the communist leader Mao and the much larger force led by Chiang Kai-shek, which was the official Chinese government. And in fact, there was an American aircraft squadron called the Flying Tigers that was flying with Chiang Kai-shek's army against the Japanese in China, led by a guy by the name of Claire Chennault. So that leads to, and that leads to another anecdote, which is very interesting. Jimmy Doolittle lands in this rice paddy, and he's rescued by some Chinese peasants who lead him to a mission. Now, the mission is run by an American Baptist missionary in China, speaks Chinese, been there for many years. He is fervently anti-communist and anti-Japanese. His name is John Birch. And for those in the audience who don't know what that name means, he's the name for which the John Birch Society gets its name.
Interesting.
Now, Birch helped.
Interesting.
Yeah, Birch, yes, he helps Jimmy Doolittle to safety. Doolittle gets back to safety, and he turns to Claire Chennault, the guy who runs the Flying Tigers. And he says, there is this missionary over there in China who speaks good Chinese, and you should recruit this guy as an intelligence asset to help get information on the Japanese. And they did. And John Birch spent the rest of the war working for the OSS, American preliminary or precursor to the CIA, and with Claire Chennault's Flying Tigers. And he goes on throughout the war to a distinguished career serving our intelligence as an intelligence asset. And then 3 days after the war ends, he is murdered by the communists in China, by Mao's communists.
Interesting.
Which is what led to the birth of the John Birch Society, was in their fervently anti-communist stance.
That's right. One, maybe you mentioned it, and I didn't quite catch it. When did President Roosevelt find out that the mission had been a success? Did he have to wait until Doolittle got back, or was he able to get some radio information?
No, Doolittle radioed in as he was flying over Tokyo. The bombs were bombs away. So the president knew, and the president went on national radio, and he informed the country over the radio in one of his radio addresses, which John Voight did a great job in the movie Pearl Harbor of recreating that speech. Would you like to hear it?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So this
I always enjoy these audio.
Go
ahead. Yeah, go ahead. No, I was just going to tell you that I always enjoy your audio contributions. They're absolutely great.
So this is John Voight playing, but doing a very good job of recreating a speech by FDR following the Doolittle raid.
Great.
Burning Rome and Tokyo, we have been described as a nation of weaklings and playboys who hire British or Russian or Chinese soldiers to do our fighting force. Let them repeat that now. Let them tell that to General MacArthur. Let them tell that the soldiers today are fighting hard in the far waters of the Pacific. Let them tell that to the boys in the flying fortresses. Let them tell that to the Marines.
And, of course, that saying, tell it to the Marines, became a famous quip that Americans in my father's generation would say as a retort. Buddy,
right.
Tell it to the Marines. So that was the – so
now
what
happened – I was going to ask you, what happened to the aircraft itself? I know they crashed. Were they ever recovered or did they just get lost forever?
No, those were all destroyed on the crash, or their remnants were recovered by the Japanese. None of them were intact. Eight of the crews were captured by – eight men of the crews were captured and executed by the Japanese by firing squad. Another interesting story comes out. It's one of the planes – the only plane that didn't crash in China flew all the way to Vladivostok in Russia, which is on the Pacific
Coast. Oh, my
coast,
goodness.
Where,
that's pretty far.
Yes, it did. It would have made further than any of the other ones. And that crew was actually treated pretty well by the Russians. The Russians were at peace with Japan. They had a neutrality pact. If you recall, way earlier in some of our World War II episodes, we had talked about how before the war, the Japanese and the Russians had fought a war during the 1930s, a very brief border war. And that led to a peace treaty, which they maintained all throughout World War II until the very last year, last months, when Russia finally did attack Japan. So the Japanese
and that city of just a quick thing I wanted to say, that city of Vladislavsk, is where President Ford and Premier Brezhnev met
year
when Ford was president shortly after the Nixon resignation, or maybe the next year, he and Brezhnev met at that city. That's one of those names I'll never forget. It's a very unusual word. I mean, it's very difficult to say it, but once you hear it, you always attach it to that meeting between Ford and Brezhnev years later.
Well, so this crew that was interned at Vladivostok, they were kept by the Russians. They were not treated badly. They weren't sent to a prison camp, but they were sent by the Russians to internment in a city north of Iran in Central Asia. In 1943, the Russian NKVD, which is the precursor to the KGB, arranged a secret mission in which, pretending to be British agents, the Russian NKVD smuggled them out of Russia and into Iran to safety, because at that point the Russians were our allies, and they didn't want to violate their treaty with Japan, but they wanted to get those American flyers back into the war. So they actually helped them into Iran, where they were able to eventually rejoin our side.
It's amazing how all of these countries that we're familiar with now, they were in different places as far as the United States back then. I mean, as far as who we were fighting who, it's just interesting. You mentioned Iran, you mentioned China. I mean, it's just interesting how, you know, the countries are still there, but our relationships with them are not the same, Barry, as they were back during the days of Doolittle. It's just interesting.
Yeah, things have
things
have changed a bit, haven't they?
They have, but it's interesting to hear. You know, I remember watching this movie one time with Ingrid Bergman, where she goes as a missionary to China. I think it's in the early part of the 20th century, The Yang of Six Happiness, which is one of my favorite movies. It's really a good movie, but it talks about China. This is a little bit before World War II, actually, but it's just interesting how how much China itself has changed. Now, we've got a couple of others. I don't know if we'll be able to get to them, but the Battle of the Java Sea and the Coral Sea, do you want to fit those in today?
Yeah, we talked about Java Sea already. That was the battle in which the Americans, the British and the Dutch were defeated. Now, one interesting thing is about that battle. I'm just going to mention this one last thing about Battle of Java Sea, because it took place before the Doolittle Raid, was that the Americans and the British, particularly the Americans, had a really terrible torpedo. Our torpedoes often would not detonate on impact. The detonators were just awful. And it wasn't until 1943 that we had a decent torpedo. One of the reasons the Japanese were able to invade the Philippines so successfully was because even though there were American submarines out there looking for the transports, and in fact torpedoed several Japanese transports and other kinds of craft, very often the torpedoes wouldn't detonate. And when that happens, of course, the submarine has fired its wad and it's been chased by destroyers and has to flee. So the Battle of Java Sea occurs, and the Japanese have quite a different situation. They have these things called long lance torpedoes, which have tremendous range, never fail to detonate, and do tremendous damage. So one of the reasons we lost the Battle of Java Sea was because the Japanese would throw down this massive number of torpedoes at very long range. And while we're trying to hit their ships with 8-inch guns, they're hitting us with torpedoes at twice the range. So it was a disaster. And many ships were sunk, including one American cruiser. So after the Doolittle Raid comes the Battle of the Coral Sea, and this is the first big battle between aircraft carriers going at it without capital ships of other kinds. A capital ship is a ship such as a battleship or an aircraft carrier that's meant to be the main battleship of whatever flotilla it's part of. Up until the Battle of the Coral Sea, the main capital ship for almost every navy was the battleship. Mounted with very large guns, usually between 14 and 16-inch guns, much larger than you see in any land-based artillery. But the Coral Sea was a battle between the Americans and the Japanese. It was near New Guinea and the Solomon Islands. And it resulted in a stalemate, maybe a tactical victory for the Japanese. They lost a couple of light carriers. We lost the Lexington, which had to be scuttled because it was so badly damaged. Yorktown was also damaged, but managed to get away. But it made a difference to us. So even though it was a tactical victory for the Japanese, strategically, it made a big difference because one of the carriers we knocked out was the aircraft carrier Shikoku, which had been at Pearl Harbor. And it was unable to be present at the Battle of Midway, which would follow the following month. And the fact that that was not there Midway made the difference, because we would have been overwhelmed by Japanese aircraft at Midway, but instead ended up with rough parity between the two air powers. So that's
interesting.
Let me ask you one quick question.
Go ahead and finish. No, I was just going to ask you. I was just going to put a calendar on where we are right now. It would be toward the second half of 1942, right? Are we in the first half? Okay. So this would be June or so?
Yeah, let me give you a quick rundown. So the Battle of the Java Sea takes place early in the year. It takes place before the Doolittle Raid, which is in April. And the Japanese invade throughout February, are invading all the islands of Sumatra, Java, Borneo, Dutch Indonesia. That's in February of 1942. A week before the Doolittle Raid, actually 9 days before the Doolittle Raid, Bataan surrenders. MacArthur escapes with his famous saying, "I shall return." That takes place in March, April of 1942. Then on the 18th of April is the Doolittle Raid. And then finally the Battle of the Coral Sea is in May, a month later, on May 4th through May 8th, 1942. So that brings us
to... in the first half of 1942. I mean, that's where we are. And
that's right.
And that's, of course, in the Pacific, but the war, of course, is going on very much in Europe at this time as well. And I'm sure we'll get to that. We kind of touched on that a little bit before, but I'm sure we'll get back to it later. But so, I mean, this is a very difficult time for the United States. I mean, just it must have felt overwhelming for President Roosevelt at this time, you know, the challenge, Barry.
And that's why it was so important that we did the Doolittle raid. It was something
right.
we could hang our hat on and say we'd actually struck a blow. Because, as I said, we had been losing nonstop before that. The Battle of Coral Sea was a loss. We lost aircraft carrier, but at least we could say that we hurt the enemy as well. But all this was going to change the following month, in June of 1942. Because of the Doolittle raid, Admiral Yamamoto, under pressure from his bosses back in Tokyo, who were insulted that the Navy was not able to defend the home islands from attack, pressured him to do something about it. And because he thought that the raid had come from the nearest island, which is Midway Island, he puts into motion a plan to invade Midway Island and move on from there to Hawaii and take Hawaii. Which, by the way, is something they should have done probably immediately after Pearl Harbor, but failed to do. And so the Battle of Midway would become the turning point. This we're going to talk about our next session.
And that's going to be our next program. Yeah.
That's right.
So
Battle of Midway, which was the turning point of the war in the Pacific.
And that's going to be our next episode. We'll start with the Battle of Midway. Well, as always, Barry, thank you so much for your time, and it's just absolutely wonderful to listen to you. You must be a good storyteller because you do a great job in putting all of this together and presenting it. I just want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the show, and we'll do it again. We'll continue with the Battle of Midway the next time.
Well, I look forward to it, and thank you for having me on again.
And I got you with Admiral Halsey and Uncle Albert, didn't I?
you did indeed. And by the way, my condolences about your Cowboys. They had a good year.
Yes, they sure did. They had a good year. That was a very tough game. They just waited until the second half to start playing. That's the unfortunate part. But
they played a great second half. Yes,
that's it.
It's a two-half game. You got to play both halves.
That's it. And if they had just played a little bit better in the first half, who knows? Maybe they'd be in the Super Bowl. I thought they were going to get to the Super Bowl, but I guess we'll have to wait till next year, as they say.
I was actually looking forward to another Dallas-Pittsburgh Super Bowl. Those were absolutely the best Super Bowls of all time.
I think so, especially 13. I think 13 was the great one, you know, where Jackie Smith dropped that pass and you know, that pass from Staubach forever. I mean, poor Jackie. I mean, they keep showing that movie, you know, at ESPN or the NFL channel. I just feel sorry for Jackie because that's all we remember of Jackie. It was otherwise a pretty good tight end, actually. He had a pretty good career, but that's all we remember, that pass from Staubach and Jackie just dropping it and Tom Landry's face, you know. I've seen it so many times. I think I've memorized every frame of it, Barry.
Well, yeah, I have a quick story to tell. Do we have time to
tell
a quick Dallas Cowboy story? So my favorite Dallas Cowboy of all time was Dandy Don. Dandy Don Meredith was the quarterback of the Cowboys in the 60s. Later went on to have a stellar career as a television broadcaster.
He did, yeah.
So Dandy Don, in one of the games, I can't remember who their opponent was, he got knocked down time after time after time, and they actually broke several of his ribs. This is when quarterbacks didn't wear a lot of pads, and there were almost no rules about smashing the quarterback. That was sort of that was the goal, was to smash the quarterback. And I think it was against the Rams. I think it was Deacon Jones who had done this to him. But he got knocked down, and he actually was spitting blood. He was coughing up blood. One of the ribs had broken and lacerated the lung. And Meredith was coughing blood, and he'd be flat on his back looking at the sky. And Randy White or one of his other defensive linemen would come over and help him up. Bob Lilly, one of the other guys. And he'd say, you want to come off the field? And you want to go sit down? And he'd say, no, just stand me back up and put me in the huddle. And he went on and kept on getting hit and kept on throwing the ball. And I'll tell you, that was the bravest performance I've ever seen of anybody on a football field.
That sounds like him. I mean, he was a tough player, and I have a question. I'm not sure about the answer. We'll have to research the answer for the next time. But I think Dandy Don was in the booth with Frank Gifford and Howard Cosell the night that they announced John Lennon's death to the country. It was announced on Monday Night Football. And I'm pretty sure that Meredith was in the booth. I know Gifford was in the booth, and so was Howard Cosell. But I don't remember if Meredith was the other one. It was about that time that he was on the NFL Monday Night game. But I'm going to look that up and tell you the next time we get together. You left me thinking there about Dan Meredith.
Well, I'll look forward to that next time.
All right, Barry. Have a wonderful day, and we'll talk later.
I look forward to it. Take care. Thank you again.
Thank you so much. Barry Jacobson, our military historian, good friend of our show. And we've been doing these shows about World War II now for several weeks. And I tell you, they're fascinating. There's so much information about World War II. It's just one of those things that, you know, I think it's in a four-year period, more details and more information about this war than I would have ever thought. All the personalities, everything else. Silvio Canto in Dallas, thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you later.